It's one of the few topics that almost all of us can agree on, healthcare, and the cost of our prescriptions are simply too expensive. The question is, how do we fix the problems? Welcome to The Full Story on WSHU and online at WSHU.org. I'm Ron Ropiak. This is a subject that I know many of you will have an opinion on. So now's the time to get those thoughts and comments in. Healthcare, buying your meds, trying to get them at an affordable price for your kids or your parents. How should this be fixed? What are your suggestions? Or if you simply just want to vent, go ahead. Think of it as a form of therapy, and I won't even charge you the $150 an hour. Our email is tfs@wshu.org, and you can find us on two spots on Twitter, FullStoryWSHU, and I have my own at RonRopiakWSHU. Oh, you know what? We're also on Facebook at The Full Story. As I mentioned, there are plenty of suggestions for how to fix this nagging problem, and there are many people doing their best. Kevin Lembo is Connecticut State Controller. Kevin, thanks for coming in.
It's good to see you again, Ron.
Same here. You have the reputation of someone who goes head-to-head with the drug companies. Would you think, is that correct?
Well, look, I wasn't hired to make nice, right? I was hired to identify problems and try to come up with solutions. So if that means I go head-to-head sometimes, it's true. But I'll also say that when we've passed big legislation in past years, it was collaborative. So it really depends on the issue. It's all circumstantial.
Okay, so with that in mind, why are prescription drug prices so high in our country and in our state?
Well, there's a number of pieces to this. Okay, so one is, and we're all aware, that the United States pays for much of the base science for most innovation around pharmaceutical drugs, meaning universities that are publicly sponsored, the NIH and other federal agencies are doing all of this base science. And often the pharmaceutical industry will take that base science and then turn it into the next blockbuster drug. And I want to be clear, at some point I'm going to need a medication to cure a thing, and we want that innovation, right? Mm-hmm. And that has a price tag to it. But the old model of, yes, okay, I am a company and I'm in the pharmaceutical space and I'm going to research, come up with this drug, get it approved, get it to market. I'm going to recoup my expenses, and then I'm going to put it out at a reasonably priced above that to, after we recoup. That part has gone away. It's whatever the market will bear. It's all the hinkiness around, is this really a new drug or is it not? Is there pay for delay around generics or is there not? And then the American public starts to get wind that if they flew or drove to Canada, if they flew to Europe, they would be paying 10%, 25% of what we as the U.S. are paying for those drugs. And we're starting to get a little annoyed now, right? Because we've paid for the base science, but yet everyone else is getting the drugs cheaper. So are we in charge as the United States of exporting innovation around the world? Well, maybe, but it would seem to me that there needs to be some sort of trade-off for that. Mm-hmm. So you get good players, you get bad players in this space, and then we've got to do whatever we can to make a difference through regulation and through market pressure.
I think that always gets lost in the narrative that a lot of these blockbuster drugs, as you mentioned, that come out nowadays, they're taxpayer funded. We were the ones who were footing the bills at the very beginning.
Right. And look, there is some risk to the company, right, to take that base science and turn it into an innovative new product. And they should be compensated for that. I'm a market guy. I'm a capitalist, you know, at mm-hmm. heart. But regulating that space really matters. Like, so I'll tell you, last year, not this past legislative year, but the one before, we passed a piece of legislation that would name drugs and drug makers who increase their price above a certain threshold. Some called it the naming and shaming bill. Others called it data collection. I was in the second group. But it allowed us to track and give an opportunity for those companies to come in and say, this is why our drug went up 1,000%. And there are reasons why it could, right? Did the factory burn down? Did the elements of the drug increase in cost beyond their control? Or are they just doing it because they want to put more ads on TV or hire more lobbyists or build up their share price, you know, for their investors? Sure. The second group of reasons needs to be challenged a little bit. And we need to question how much is too much, particularly when it's not a real market, right? It's not a real economic market with all of the compare and contrast, weights and prices. options that you have when you're buying peas or corn, you know, in the grocery store, for
example.
You're stuck, and you're blind, right? Your doctor says, here's a script, go get this drug filled, and they get to the counter, and they say, you know, $772.
And you think to yourself, and we've had people email us, they say, my parents, if they have to buy these medications, will stop eating, or they'll get the meds, but they will only take a half a pill a day that they're supposed to be taking.
Right, which may or may not have the full effect of what they're trying to get at. It could be just like wasting money at that point, taking half a pill. The reason I bring that up is pharma, together with some others, came together with us to pass that legislation because the traditional pharmaceutical companies understand who the bad actors are, and it's not always them. And so they figured, well, if this is out there and it's public, then it'll give everyone a chance to rationalize these price increases.
I have a number of questions, and I was going to save this one till later. But to be honest, I'm going to bring it up now because you had mentioned Canada. And I hear about more and more specifically seniors who are going to Canada to pick up their prescriptions. Why can't we do that? Why shouldn't someone do that?
Yeah, well, we had a bill this year that would have allowed reimportation of drugs. So not just one-offs, not just, you know, mom and dad get in the car and drive to Ottawa for the weekend and come back with their medications, but a full-blown state program that would have allowed reimportation of drugs, sometimes American drugs, ironically, back into the U.S. from Canada. Canada at the prices that the Canadians are negotiating. We don't negotiate for price.
But I just want to be clear. So when you say reimportation, so you mean the drugs are being manufactured in the U.S.,
in some
being
cases.
Shipped to another country,
yes.
And then we would go buy it there at
and
a cheaper price and bring it back.
Right. Right. Crazy by most definitions.
Yes, it does sound crazy.
Right. It does sound crazy. But the Canadian governments, the provincial governments of Canada have been brave. They've stepped up and said, no, we're going to negotiate on price and on value, not just on price, because it's easy to get to cheap. Mm-hmm. It's hard to get to value, right? Mm. So if this drug works better, it's going to be a little bit more expensive, but we're just not going to let you price it at whatever you want. And when you're talking about a provincial, regional, state, federal approach to that, then you've got some leverage. Like my own program that I run is 250,000 lives, 250,000 people based on the contracts that I negotiate. Well, when I enter the room, they want to do business with us. So why not use that
You're
as
going
an opportunity?
To give them money.
I'm going to
it
give
comes,
them money, but maybe not as
it.
Much because I'm going to give them some volume.
So is it simply that Canada has cheaper drug prices because they're able to negotiate better prices? Is that all it is?
Yes, full stop.
You know that there's some people listening to this right now and they're hearing this and they're saying that's crazy.
Well, they're right. And this is the moment where federal intervention and state level intervention is necessary. This is the time for the people to, rise up and call their elected representatives and say, this is out of control. You need to do something about this. I heard legislators throughout this session talk about the number one issue they encountered at the doors when they were door knocking leading up to the election, Republicans and Democrats alike. Healthcare, the cost of healthcare and the cost of pharmaceutical drugs.
Would anyone be breaking any type of rule or law or anything like that if we went and we got our drugs there?
Well, individually, technically you shouldn't, but I don't know that there's a lot of policing. If the state was going to do a program, then it would have to receive a waiver from the federal government. But we'd already heard that President Trump said to the governor of Florida that he would be in favor of a reimportation program for that state. Now, I don't know if that stays stuck. You never know with this administration if it's going to actually still be there the next day. But that was a good sign.
So theoretically, there's a chance that Connecticut could, as a state, go to Canada and buy these drugs and then bring them back for those that you're taking care of, that you're negotiating
yep.
for.
Go for the most expensive and highly utilized medications statewide and go off and just pick the first 25 to start, right? Just go off, negotiate those, hire a wholesaler that will be in charge of the reimportation and the wholesaling, and then redistribute them out to the pharmaceutical chain and let them be distributed that way.
What are you hearing from other state officials and from legislators? What are they thinking
about
this?
Well, session's over now. unfortunately, opportunity lost. But TikTok, summer, then comes winter, then comes a new opportunity to try again.
So you're going to try again and just keep trying again over the next few years?
Absolutely.
How many people are in favor of something like this in terms of a majority vote in the legislature?
Generally, this has broad-based support on both sides of the aisle. So I think if it can get through the nonsense of
all the
fights
hearings
between chambers and fights between the governor's office and the legislature, I think we could absolutely get this done.
So are there other states doing this, or would Connecticut be the first?
No, Connecticut would not be the first, but Vermont is a little bit ahead of us. They had a little bit of trouble getting their program off the ground, I think mostly because it's Vermont. You know, where Connecticut is not large, based on population, we're bigger than Vermont. You know, so you could start to see a New England coalition, for example, come together. You know, maybe other New England states would want to join with us. If we could get Massachusetts on board, it would be a huge hit.
I have to say, it sounds like common sense.
It does. It's practically complicated, but people don't need to worry about that piece, right? That's why we have a government to take care of that.
Right. And if this does happen, your best guess as to when something like this.
It's really hard to tell because you have to go out to bid for that wholesaler contract. You have to assume you're going to get good pricing.
So a few years down the line at this
easily
point.
Easily 2 years after it's passed, yes.
Kevin Lembo is with us. He is Connecticut's controller. And he's the guy who goes out and negotiates the deals for the state and tries to keep the healthcare costs down. You had what some people describe as a nice win recently. Tell us about it.
Yeah, well, 2 years worth of work and a staff that's done an amazing job. And we went out to bid for our pharmacy contract for state employees and their dependents, retirees and their dependents, and some municipal folks as well. About 250,000 lives. And we were able to, at the end of the day, negotiate 10% in savings off our current year spend, which equates to somewhere between $30 and $33 million year over year in savings for Connecticut taxpayers.
That's a lot of money. And that was simply, but you said it was a 2 year process where you basically have to go to the companies and say, this is what we're willing to spend. We were just talking about Canada. Was the specter of Canada in the background when you were negotiating these deals?
It was, because the conversation was hot and heavy up at the Capitol at the time. But really, this particular request for proposals, RFP process that we go through, was really based on a couple of things. One was to align the incentives, right, to make sure that the pharmacy benefit manager, the PBM, and the doctor and the patient all were, you know, like moving in the same direction. And that's an important thing, because sometimes when a company is paid on a percentage of the total, the bigger the total, the better it off it is for them, but it's not good for the plan. We end up spending more, sometimes unnecessarily. So we wanted to make sure that we were clear. We're only going to pay the cost of the drug plus a small administrative fee across the board. We engaged them in what we called a reverse auction, meaning we got down to the last two or three companies and then put them in these lightning rounds of competing on both the cost and the terms of the contract, and said, look, here's the 10 categories we're interested in. Here's the terms. You know, come back in 48 hours with your best. And they would come back in and then would eliminate one and would do it again with whoever was left. And it enabled us to squeeze down. They weren't used to doing things that way. They, the pharmacy benefit managers, that are really just insurance companies, right, for pharmacy benefits. We took the best thinking from around the country, our own research as well. And the RFP and ultimately the contract that we signed with them is groundbreaking, and I don't use that word loosely, not just in the public sector, not just in Connecticut, but nationally in the private and public sectors.
You and I have talked in the past on the phone about pharmacy benefit managers, PBMs, and the more I read about them and the more I try to understand about them, the more confused I get. They seem to have such an outsized role in what we do, and in the meantime, trying to understand how they got to that position is just, well, I can't. And from the news reports that I see, I think many of the reporters can't understand it either. Who are PBMs and how do they get that job?
Yeah. So I remember a business school professor when I was an undergrad say, if you really want to make money without doing a heck of a lot, get yourself wedged between the supply and the demand, right? You don't have to make the thing and you don't have to actually consume the thing. You just need to like be the one who passes it back.
You're the middleman.
So that's the middleman. The PBM is a middleman. Health insurance companies are middlemen, right? That's really what they do. They bear risk and they take everybody's money in and they hope at the end of the day they don't spend more than they took in. And usually they don't. It's a shadowy world. And I don't mean like in the like...
Cosa Nostra.
No,
something like
not
that.
At all.
Okay.
But it has had a lack of transparency for a very long time. People sometimes think, you know, X company makes this drug and then my pharmacy gets it and I pay for it and I take it. Well, it changes hands, you know, three or four other times before it actually is sitting on your kitchen counter. The PBMs have a piece. There's wholesalers involved in all of that. And everybody who touches it takes a piece of the action. And so when we talked about why prices are increasing in the first segment, this is another way, because you have all these intermediaries now who are taking a piece of the action and driving up the cost as a result.
So these PBMs are based in Connecticut, or are they based anywhere in the country and they simply do the work for the drug manufacturers?
Yeah, so they are national. There are some local ones, but the big ones that really have the market heft to be able to like compete for our business, for example, are the nationals. Mm-hmm. CVS Caremark is one of those. They are our legacy provider for the state employee retiree plan and just re-won the bid. But they are now, you know, very much part of Aetna. And, you know, so there are companies now that are insurance companies and PBMs that are buying each other up. And we call that vertical integration. So you have more of that sort of a silo of every piece of it is owned by one company, mm-hmm. Which really demands a higher level of monitoring, because if not, you know, there can be some gamesmanship that's played there.
So if I can understand this correctly, because I'm having a little trouble understanding it. So CVS will then determine who gets certain prescriptions, certain drugs, and they set the price for them. So if I'm an independent pharmacy, I have to go to CVS to get these medicines?
Right, because an independent pharmacy, as an example, can't go to every single pharmaceutical wholesaler or pharma company and negotiate for every possible drug that's out there. So they rely on the PBMs to do that, but it does put them in direct negotiation with the PBMs mm-hmm. To not only get their book of business, but also to negotiate with them around price.
So CVS will be selling these meds, but then also selling them to other independent pharmacies. Why doesn't this sound correct to me? Why doesn't it sound right?
So because trust your gut. There's a lot about this that should make us uneasy, but that's why we've negotiated historic transparency in these contracts. We're forcing them to open the books to us, to send our people in whenever we'd like to take a look. It's also interesting that the contract demands that at the moment of prescription, when the doc has your medical record up on the screen and is trying to figure out what pharmacy you use, mm-hmm. as soon as they hit the drug now, a pop-up window will come and it'll let them know what the cost of that medication is to the plan, how much will actually be paid for it, because often the shiniest new medication in the market is not the best. Sometimes those workhorse generics or workhorse brand name drugs are a much more better bang for the buck, and the real value is there.
The State Attorney General William Tong is going to be on in a few minutes, and we're going to be talking about generic drugs.
I'm a big fan of RIG.
You were the state's first healthcare advocate back in, was it 2004?
2004, yes.
Time flies, doesn't it?
6 years in that job.
So you've been at this for a while, and I remember we spoke about this issue a long time ago. Why does it seem like Groundhog Day, that we're kind of in the same spot?
I think the fact pattern changes a little bit, but those who are going to exploit this market are always going to have better tools than the rest of us. And so it is like whack-a-mole. We're always watching for the new thing. And as they figure out new ways to make money, we have to figure out new ways to regulate and new ways to negotiate. And so that happens to be the nature of a market-driven healthcare system. You know, that's never going to go away.
I have to ask you, this program is airing a week or two after the presidential debates. As someone who's been doing this for a long time, when you were watching the debates and you're hearing the candidates talk about Medicare for all, universal healthcare, was there anything that jumped out at you? Was there anything that you said, yes, this is the way that this country should be going?
I think when we strive for ideological purity on a question like this is when we run into trouble. And I think there are hybrid solutions to our problem that have been vetted and proven in other countries to work well. I look at the Dutch example, where you have both a private and a public system that work hand in glove. Everyone has access to the public system, but then there's the add-on if people want additional coverage, sort of like a Medicare wrap or supplemental program. It can't be all one or the other. I'm not a fan of that. I just don't know that we would be able to get there when you consider the nature of our economy, where people are employed, what would they do, all of that. But I think if you regulate the heck out of this thing and you put some real public options available to stand with and compete next to it, and you demand transparency and you have regulators do their work, we could have a much better, more high-performing system than the one we have right now.
Connecticut State Controller Kevin Lembo. Kevin, thank you. It was a pleasure.
Always good to see you.
Now I'm going to bring in the Connecticut Attorney General, William Tong. Attorney General Tong, always good to speak with you, sir.
Hey, Ron.
We're talking today about health care and a complaint that's been with us forever. Why is health care so expensive? Now, your office is targeting one specific aspect of this, generic drug manufacturers. Can you tell us more, please?
Well, it's one specific aspect that accounts for 90% of all prescriptions written in this country. What we've uncovered is that there is a massive industry-wide conspiracy to fix prices and to allocate market share among the major drug manufacturers making generic drugs. That is highly illegal. And it answers, in part, a really important question that all of us ask every day, which is, why are drug prices so high, particularly generic drug prices that were supposed to go down? And now we know that there's a widespread conspiracy, that there's collusion in the marketplace to rig the market and to steal billions of dollars from the American people and from families in Connecticut.
So you're saying that some of the manufacturers decided to work together to plan their strategies, and you say you have the evidence to back it up?
Almost all of them. And so this is a piece of litigation that started under my predecessor, George Jepson, and it really focused on one company, Heritage Pharmaceuticals, although we did name a number of other companies. And then in early May, we filed another complaint, this time focused on the largest generic drug manufacturer in the world, known as Teva Pharmaceuticals. And just last week, the court unsealed a complaint. The complaint in that case, it was previously redacted. We unsealed it, and now you can read all of the allegations, and it shows that Teva, along with the other major generic drug manufacturers, openly, brazenly, shamelessly colluded on price. They were talking, for example, about a blood pressure medication, and they were talking back and forth about how and when and at what level they were going to set the price. They talked about splitting up the marketplace between different manufacturers and saying, you get this customer, I get this customer. And if we all, quote unquote, play nice in the sandbox, we'll all make money. That's just highly, highly illegal. Under the antitrust laws of our nation, it's known as being illegal per se. And they know this, and they do it anyway. And that has cost consumers and Connecticut families billions of dollars.
Now, there was a statement from Teva that was published, and it reads, Teva continues to review the issue internally and has not engaged in any conduct that would lead to civil or criminal liability.
Yeah, they better hurry up and review it, because we have emails, text messages, phone records. We have 11 million phone records, 7 million documents. We have a number of cooperating witnesses. We've got the Department of Justice hot on their trail. And you know, just this week, it's funny, the Generic Drug Industries Trade Association is the Association for Accessible Medicine. And he wrote an op-ed in the Hartford Courant saying that basically this is just politicians talking and we're just posturing and there's nothing to see here. They did nothing wrong. If we didn't have evidence and we didn't have extensive evidence and proof of their wrongdoing, do you think 49 states would be joined together in a coalition suing the entire industry? No, come on. We have direct evidence showing direct competitor-competitor collusion and communication. competitors talking to each other on a competitor-to-competitor basis on days in on which they raised prices of specific drugs like blood pressure medications, heart medications that we take every day to live in this country. I take a drug every day called doxycycline. It's for a basic common skin condition. And that drug went up 8,000% in the past few years. And this is among generic drugs. The whole point of the generic drug industry was that when patent protection expired, generic drug manufacturers would enter the marketplace and they would compete on price because there's no difference between the various generic drugs and their formulations. So the price was supposed to go down, and instead it has gone up.
Can you tell us how long this was going on?
It's been going on for a long time. Our investigation started in 2014. It started by two attorneys in our office reading about a heart medication, Digoxin, going up in unnatural and unexplainable amount starting in 2012. So our investigation engagement, I guess, goes back as far as 2012. We suspect it's been going on well before that. The generic drug market was created, in fact, by Congress in 1984 for the very purpose of creating competition and forcing prices down. And unfortunately, because of the misconduct of the manufacturers, prices have gone up. And what galls me is that they release these statements and they use their lobbyists and the companies say, just not true. We haven't done that. And my response is, what part of I have evidence that you're talking directly to your competitors about price increases is not true? And what part of that is legal? None of it.
Now, to be clear, how many manufacturers are we talking about? And are there any who were not engaging in the alleged price fixing?
We're talking about 20. I don't have a catalog in front of me of every generic drug manufacturer. And so I hesitate to say that it's every last player in the market, but it's the major players. And it's 20 of them, and they account for almost the entire market.
So were there any who were not engaging? I mean, are there any that you could say that there were some honest brokers here?
Not off the top of my head. Again, our complaint is focused on these 20 manufacturers. Our investigation covers the entire industry, and we're continuing to push that investigation, and we learn more every day.
Now, this is big news. You were on 60 Minutes with this, and some say this may be the biggest price-fixing scheme in U.S. history. But are you worried that what you and other states are trying to do will get pushed to the side because of the amazing amount of news nowadays?
No, I mean, I think that this strikes so deep into the core of what all of us care about from a policy and public policy perspective, and what matters to all of us every day in our everyday lives and to our families. Healthcare. Yeah, healthcare is a broad issue. It matters to all of us. But the price of prescription drugs, it's an everyday pressing thing that's top of mind for all of us. So I don't worry at all that this doesn't register on, the top priorities for all of us because it does. And because what we take to live and survive could not be more important.
Attorney General Tong, as the lawsuit proceeds and then let's say it goes to a settlement, am I going to get some money back as a consumer?
We hope so. I don't know if this is going to get settled. I don't know if this is going to get tried. We're preparing for trial, and we're preparing to take on all the generic drug manufacturers in court and holding them accountable for their misconduct. So, we're pushing forward towards a trial. And we're not focused on a settlement, but our hope and expectation is that we're going to force these generic drug manufacturers to pay back the billions of dollars that they stole from the American people. And then we'll figure out with our multi-state partners, 49 states in all, how we will distribute the money that was stolen from us among the states.
I know you mentioned that you're preparing for trial. Can you give me a timeline? How does this play out?
No, it's going to take some time. We've got a number of different fronts open in our investigation. We expect there to be more cases, more complaints, more defendants. So it's going to take a little bit.
Okay. Now, I'm assuming you watched the Democratic presidential debates. Were you just like the rest of us and sat there and watched the tube?
I watched some of it. That 4 hours is an awful long time.
It is a long time. What did you think about when they were talking about health care?
You know, I think that I think what it demonstrated to me was that these are huge policy issues, that the federal government has a role. But frankly, as Washington is largely broken and unable to do the basic policy work in the Congress of the American people, that a lot of these fights devolve to the states, and that state controllers like Kevin Lembo and state attorneys general and the 56 of us, including territories and districts, that a lot of this work on health care, on generic drugs, on opioids, that falls to the states.
Finally, before I let you go, can you give us an update on where the opioid lawsuit stands? Have there been any updates since we last spoke, which was about a month or so ago?
Yeah, there's a trial going on now in Oklahoma involving Johnson & Johnson and others. There are ongoing conversations among attorneys general, and we've had a number of sit-downs with companies in the industry who we think are responsible, and we're telling them, you guys are in big trouble. We are on a large national scale coming after all of you, and we're going to hold you accountable. And we're showing them the evidence that we have and encouraging them to do the right thing. Now, I'm not terribly optimistic at this point that they're going to do the right thing and just step forward and admit culpability and pay billions of dollars to fund treatment and prevention. But that's part of the process, which is to demand that they repair the damage that they've done and pay for the treatment and prevention that we need. There was recently a meeting of state attorneys general. We met in Denver, and I think 36 of us were actually present, and the rest were represented in the room, and we talked confidentially about our strategy going forward in terms of the national opioid investigation and litigation, and we're continuing to focus not just on the manufacturers, but also on distributors of drugs and all the other players in what I call the addiction industry.
I read a report the other day that basically said, okay, some settlements have already been made, but now there are disputes as to where the money is going to be spent. I guess that's a huge part of this in terms of what you're working on.
Yeah, I wouldn't call them disputes. I mean, I think state attorneys general have been down this road before. We did it with tobacco. We do it regularly on other multi-state settlements, for example, against Equifax. I just signed a settlement agreement not long ago. We did it with the National Mortgage Servicers. So we have experience in this area. This is obviously a huge undertaking. The opioid investigation may be the biggest since tobacco. And so it's complex, which is why the AGs had to get together in a room, which we have to do periodically to really hash out some of these issues, but we'll get there.
Connecticut State Attorney General William Tong, thank you, sir. We always appreciate your time.
Thank you, Ron.
It's The Full Story on WSHU, and we're going to conclude our conversation today by spending a few minutes with Chris Widello. Chris is the Associate State Director for AARP New York. Chris, how are you? Thanks for joining us.
Hey, good afternoon. Thanks for having me.
I'd like to turn it back to what we were talking about earlier in the program, and that's about importing prescription medications from Canada simply because they're cheaper. And I'm sure you know, four states have already done that. They've passed importation bills. The four states are Vermont, Florida, Colorado, and Maine. Now, most of our listeners are in New York and Connecticut. My question to you is, once Vermont gets up and running, can we all just drive up to Vermont and buy our drugs there, buy our medicines there?
Yeah, I suppose, but, you know, it's still would take some time, and, you know, not everybody can just hop in a car and head over to Vermont, as nice of a state as it is. And so I think, you know, it would be wise for New York to pursue its own, you know, own way to legalize this. You know, that is something, it's part of a package of three different legislative proposals that AARP is seeking. And it would, you know, we think it would be, make sense, given that we have a, we share a border with Canada, that it would make a lot of sense to have, for New York to be able to re-import safely prescription drugs from Canada.
What are the other two proposals?
Sure. So this legislative session, we asked for a few different, we were supportive of a few different measures that were introduced. One is a safe importation of prescription drugs from Canada. The other was a paid a delay legislation that would require the Attorney General in New York to, you know, post these agreements that the pharmaceutical companies are making with generic manufacturers about the types of, you know, deals that they're striking to delay the, you know, delay name brand drugs from becoming, you know, generic, right? Mm-hmm. So often these patents have run out and the exclusive terms of their agreement to produce this drug has ended, but yet the drug companies are paying the generic makers to not produce them, which is really hurting, you know, New Yorkers and Americans and when this is happening. And also anti-price gouging. So this would, you know, for instance, like epinephrine, right? It's an injection that we use to treat anaphylactic shock. The shot went up from $94 for a two-pack of these auto-injectors, this is only back in 2007, to more than $600 today. And that is, you know, I mean, that just seems outrageous that there is such a skyrocket in these prices. And we need to find out what is happening, what is driving this, and if there is price gouging, it needs to be addressed. And, you know, it just can't happen. We also have a bill that's going to be before the governor that passed both the Senate and the Assembly this past session, which is the drug formulary bill. And what it says is that, you know, drug that insurance companies that are offering a drug formulary in New York for people that are, say, on Part D, right? So they have to choose and select what prescription drug plan that they want for a given year. And in that year, they can't switch. So if their formulary changes, they are powerless to make any changes to their what they have subscribed to. So we want to level the playing field. And so this legislation that we hope the governor signs will say that drug companies, once they have, you know, established what their formulary is, they need to lock it in for a year so it's not being changed midway. And for many people that are picking their drug formularies based on their needs aren't left in a lurch when these formularies change.
Chris, I know that many who have reached retirement age in our region aren't retiring because they simply need the money to purchase medications. Do you see that as a growing problem?
Yeah, we do. You know, people are working longer for many different reasons, but we often are hearing, you know, that a lot of it has to come down to the cost of being able to afford things like prescription drugs. There was a report that was released just a few weeks ago, and it, basically the summary is that the average annual cost of just one medication needed to treat serious conditions like cancer, multiple sclerosis, arthritis, can be more than 4.5 times an older American's Social Security benefit. And that's just, you know, outrageous. I mean, it's just, it's sort of mind-boggling to think about this. We know that nearly 4 in every 10 Americans age 50 and older will skip or ration their medications, and that's according to another survey that we have, you know, that we did. And, you know, more than 6 in 10 say that prescription drugs are unreasonable. But when you think about your day-to-day expenses and the cost of prescription drugs, it's making it much harder for people to retire and you know, and live on their retirement benefits alone.
So that I know you've spoken about this in the past, that our population in the region is getting older. We're all getting older. And
yep.
with elections around the corner, I would think that some politicians would get cracking on this. So my question is a simple one. Why isn't anything happening faster? What's holding it up?
Sure. Well, you know, I think there is some agreement, and we've heard from, you know, both sides of the aisle. And, you know, remember, AARP is a nonpartisan organization. We don't endorse any candidates. We don't support any one party, and we certainly don't contribute to any political action committees. But we know that older voters are reliable voters, and they vote. And as a matter of fact, they were the story in this last election. I mean, older voters went out in much higher numbers than their younger counterparts. And, you know, and I think this issue of, you know, prescription drug affordability is gaining some traction. I mean, we have heard from both sides of the aisle that this is an issue, that this is a priority. You know, it's an American issue. It doesn't really affect one party any more than the other. You know, I think it's the job of, you know, the AARP members and the public to, you know, remind their elected officials that this is something that is important and that, there's plenty of time to start working on this issue and get something done. You know, this is really a pocketbook issue, and, you know, people's lives truly depend on the affordability of prescription drugs. But, you know, there are, you know, Washington does have its issues, and so, you know, that's why we've launched this national campaign to keep the pressure on and help amplify the voice of our over, you know, 37 million members in across the country to say that enough is enough, that we have to stop this RX greed. We have to, find ways to make prescription drugs more affordable so people can, you know, live their healthy lives and not be taken advantage of.
You're listening to The Full Story on WSHU. We're with Chris Wiedello for about another 5 minutes or so. Chris is the Associate State Director for AARP New York. Chris, if Connecticut has a special session for the legislature this summer, AARP Connecticut wants the lawmakers to put importing lower-cost prescription meds from Canada on the agenda, along with tolls and a few other things. Is there anything like that happening in New York?
So, you know, this, like as I mentioned, you know, we pushed a package of legislation this past session that just ended at the end of June. You know, from time to time, the governor does call back the legislature in the fall, and they sort of address some, things that might need, funding or, you know, but I don't know that this would necessarily be an issue in the same way it is for Connecticut. So I think our best bet is to look at the start of 2020. Which kicks off with the budget and then legislative session, which will run through June, to educate our lawmakers and the public, and really push for movement on this legislation after the new year. Not to say that it could not happen, but given past history, I don't know that this would necessarily be an issue, although we'd love it. If they wanted to come back and talk about this issue, why not? we'll be there to support, and, you know, we're certainly excited to see what transpires in Connecticut. It's interesting. The politics are a little different, but we would certainly support something like that.
And you know, quite frankly, there's no way to gauge whether or not it will happen in Connecticut. I know Connecticut
right.
AARP wants it to happen, but let's see. Chris, finally, what about some of those who are concerned about the safety with some of the drugs imported from Canada? I read a quote from a former FDA official who said, "Sometimes a bargain is too expensive." What should we think about when we read or hear that?
Well, we're the only country that pays full freight on our prescription drugs. And, you know, many countries have the same high standards that the United States has. And, you know, of course, we'd want those protections in place. I mean, we do not want a inferior product to be administered here in New York or anywhere else. So, you know, we'd want the U.S. Secretary of Health and Human Service to certify that New York State's program is safe and will, in fact, save money without compromising quality. We would certainly only want prescription drugs meeting U.S. FDA safety and effectiveness standards to be brought in. You know, the pharmaceutical market is already global. The U.S. imports more than 40% of its finished products and 80% of its active pharmaceutical ingredients, according to, what we know from the FDA. So I think, you know, as long as it's safe and it meets the high standards that we have, then why not? You know, and this is why we've long supported secretarial negotiation for Medicare. So Medicare has a pharmaceutical program known as Part D, and the Secretary of Health and Human Services is not allowed to negotiate a bulk rate for those prescription drugs. We're paying the full price that the pharmaceutical companies offer. The Secretary of Veterans Affairs, they are able to negotiate on behalf of plans, you know, like TRICARE, which many veterans are able to take care of and get lower cost prescription drugs that are still high quality. And so why shouldn't we be doing that for our Medicare beneficiaries? You know, I don't think it's I don't think necessarily reducing the cost means reducing the quality.
Chris, I only have about 45 seconds left. At the beginning of the program, I was speaking with Connecticut State Controller Kevin Lembo, and he came up with an idea, and he said, you know, maybe there's something to a consortium of states around here buying as a block, going in maybe to Canada and so on, and pooling their resources. Any interest in that?
I think it's an interesting concept, right? And how do we, you know, maximize and leverage, you know, the buying power? We know the U.S. Secretary of Health and Human Service could certainly do it for all Medicare beneficiaries if they, if Congress would like to authorize something like that. I think we would need to see a specific proposal and figure out if that makes sense for New York. So it's certainly something we consider. We just have to see sort of the details.
He had mentioned Connecticut, possibly Massachusetts. You know, we were referencing Vermont, and it just seems if they all banded together, strength in numbers, right?
A lot of population there, for sure.
Chris Wiedello is the Associate State Director for AARP New York. Chris, a pleasure. Thank you, sir.
Thank you for having me. Take care.
Be well. That's going to do it for our show today. Julie Ferdino is our engineer. Carrie Frank is the digital editor. Our associate producers are Christian Carter, Sabrina Garone, Natalie Chafari. J.D. Allen is the producer. Ann Lopez is the senior producer. And Terry Sheridan, our news director. I'm Ron Ropiak. Thanks to you for being part of The Full Story.